Megillas Esther begins, Vayehi b'mei Achashverosh. And it was in the days of Achashverosh. Chazal have something very interesting to say as a rule about the word Vayehi, and actually, more specifically, the term Vayehi b'mei. Nowadays we have Bar Ilan, we have all sorts of incredible search engines. You can basically Google Tanakh these days. In the times of Chazal, no such thing existed. Nonetheless, we find, if you take a look on your source sheet, in source number 2, that the Gemara in Maseches Megillah has a rule. Every single time you find a certain word, you know, it never ceases to amaze me. You take a look in Rashi, somewhere in Chumash, in Tanakh, anywhere, and Rashi says, this is a unique word, it's different, it doesn't appear, this word never appears anywhere else in Tanakh. You know, he didn't have Bar Ilan, he didn't have a Google search engine, he just knew, he had such a photographic knowledge of Torah, he's able to make a definitive statement, this word appears nowhere else. It never ceases to amaze me. The Gemara says, Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, Amar Rabbi Levi, Vitema, Rabbi Yochanan, said Rabbi Levi, and some say it was Rabbi Yochanan, Dover ze masaris bi'adeinu mi'anshei Knesset HaGdolah. This we have as a tradition, all the way back from the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. Kol makom shene'emar vayehi, anytime you find in Tanakh the term, or the word, vayehi, eino ela lashon tsar, it is only a language of suffering. Really? How do you know? So Chazal, go ahead and they prove it to you. For example, it says in the very beginning of Megillas Esther, vayehi b'mei Achashverosh, Hava Haman, in the days of Achashverosh, Haman. You don't need to go any farther than that to explain the tsar, the suffering, the troubles that befell the Jewish people right after Vayehi b'mei Achashverosh, Haman came to power, and so began the threat of the first Holocaust, Rachman al-Itzlan. Vayehi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim, the other Megillah that will be, Ezra Hashem, be learning this Zman, Megillas Rus, begins, it was in the day of the judgment of the judges. Sefer Shoftim, if you are familiar with Tanakh, so the way the Tanakh begins is first you have Chamishei Chumshei Torah, you have the five books of Moses, followed by Sefer Yehoshua. Joshua, the student of Moshe Rabbeinu, took the Jewish people into the land of Israel, and after Yehoshua became a period of what's called the Shoftim. The Shoftim were the judges, they were not really kings yet, they were Nevi'im that saved the Jewish people and were the Baalei HaMasorah. They were in charge of making sure that our tradition was passed from one generation to the next. That was the times of the Shoftim. So Megillas Rus begins, it was in the times of the judging of the Shoftim, the times of the Shoftim, Havara'av, the very beginning of the Megillah says that there was a famine, and Nomi and Elimelech are forced to leave Eretz Yisrael and go elsewhere, to the land of Moab, Amun and Moab, to go ahead and get away from the famine. And when there were so many people that had begun to be born in the world, God said, saw that man had become to be evil. And it was again when they left from the east, and they said, let's build a tower up to the heavens. That's the famous tower of Babel. They made a war. He was threatened by a fellow with an outstretched sword. So the Gemara goes on and on and on with Vayehis, where you find something tragic happening immediately afterwards. So if you skip a few lines, the Gemara has a kasha. The Gemara has a difficulty with this rule. V'haksiv. But it says, Vayehi b'yom ha-shmini, in the very beginning of Parshas Shmini. And Parshas Shmini, of course, what it means literally was on the eighth day. The eighth day of what? The eighth day of the inauguration of the tabernacle. So clearly we're talking about something which is deserving of a celebration, not something that was tragic. V'tanya, Osu ha-yom ha-isa simcha lifnei ha-kadosh baruch hu, ki-yom sh'nivru bo shamayim v'oretz. And we have a braisa that tells us that on that day there was, so to speak, simcha, happiness, in front of Hashem, like the day that He created shamayim, the heavens, v'aretz, and the earth. Yeah, how do you know? Ksiv hacha, it says over here, vayhi bayom hashmini, and it was on the eighth day. Ksiv hasam, and it says, by Bereshis, by the creation of the world, vayhi erev, vayhi voker, yom echad. So you see, that just like the simcha, and it was tov, with tov ma'od, the creation of the world, we were told, it was very good. So you see that just like by the creation of the world, there was simcha by Hashem, vayhi bayom hashmini. So how can you tell me vayhi always indicates suffering, when we have explicitly a connection, a brisa that says explicitly that as a connection to Maisa Brachos, to the creation of the world, that it was a happy day? So where in the world is Vayehi indicating tsar, indicating suffering or troubles? Answers the Gemara, Hashchev Nadavavu. So the Gemara gets out of this one. On that day, on the eighth day, were when the two sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, died. So there was a tragedy that happened that day. Okay, next. V'haksiv ayhi b'shmonim shana, v'arba meo shana, v'haksiv ayhi kasher ro Yaakov Yisrachel, v'haksiv ayer v'ayvoker yom echad, v'ayika sheinu, v'ayika shlish, v'ayika tuva. The Gemara goes on to quote at least four, five, six more places where you find v'ayhi, and absolutely nothing negative happening. In fact, to the contrary, on these occasions, something positive was happening. When Yaakov saw Rachel, they were going to meet, they were going to get married, they were going to have shvatim. As we just mentioned, that the Vayehi of Vayibay Mashmini, Vayevoker of the creation of the world is a Vayehi, where God says he looked at the world and it was good. In fact, Tov Ma'od, it was very good. So you have every single day, you have Vayevoker Yom Echad, Yom Sheni, Shlishi, etc., etc. Every day it says that it says Vayehi. And you don't have anything that was tragic happening. And to the contrary, on certain days you have even Hashem saying that it was good. So how can you tell me that as a rule, Vayehi always indicates Tsar? That's the kasha, that's the problem of the Gemara. Amar Ravashi, kol Vayehi igahachi v'igahachi. Ravashi answers, you're right. Anytime you find the term Vayehi, sometimes it indicates Tsar, and sometimes not. However, this is the rule, Nakot Hakfala Biyadcha, you can take this rule and stick it in your pocket. Vayihi bimei, if you ever find the term Vayihi bimei, and it was in the days of, Vayihi plus the word bimei, eino ela lashon tsar. That is only a language of tragedy. Chamisha Vayihi bimei havu, and in fact there are five of them in all of Tanakh. Vayihi bimei Achashverosh, ours, it was in the days of Achashverosh, Vayihi bimei Shvod Ashrotim, it was in the days of the judging of the judges. Vayihi bimei Amraphel, Vayihi bimei Achaz, Vayihi bimei Yehoyakim. So those are the five times that you have Vayihi bimei, and tragedy befalls Klal Yisrael, Rachmana Litzlan, in every single one of those cases. So again, the rule is that whenever you find the word Vayihi, it may indicate tragedy, but may not. But Vayihi bimei always indicates that what will follow is tragedy. That is rule number one that we see, Vayihi bimei Achashverosh. Now, the Pasuk says, Vayihi bimei Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh hamolech mehudu v'yant kush, Shev v'esru mea medina. It was in the days of Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh that ruled from Hodu to Kush, which was 127 nations. So there are obviously many things in every pasuk that we can point out. So we're going to point out certain things in each pasuk as we go along. And we're going to be focusing primarily on Rashi and the Pshat that's in our Mikros Gedolos of the Vilna Gaon, the Biur HaGra al Derech HaPshat. Now Vilna Gaon was a very, very deep thinker. And he has commentaries on Megillas Esther as well as other things on many different levels. So, for example, in Megillas Esther, he has at least three commentaries. One is called the Biur HaGra al Derech HaPshat, the simple explanation. And one is al Derech HaRemez, the hinted explanations. And finally, he has an explanation that's al Derech HaSod, that goes according to the secrets that are found in Megillas Esther. And of course, this takes us back to our discussion we had before, that Megillas Esther is certainly written with divine inspiration. Otherwise, certainly, you wouldn't be able to have these various different levels. But that's what we'll be utilizing primarily, is the Pshat of Rashi, and we'll also be learning a lot of the Vilna Gaon. That's what we'll be doing this about. So one of the questions that you right away notice in this pasuk is that it was in the days of Achashverosh. This was the Achashverosh that ruled from Hodu to Kush. Well, why is that significant? So many point out that because there was another Achashverosh, in fact the Vilna Gaon points this out right away, Mipnei Shehaya Achashverosh Acher, Vehu Avidar Yavesh Hamadai HaRishon, there was another Achashverosh, and this is the one that we're referring to, is this one, don't make a mistake. So the Gra is telling you that this is the Megillas Esther already pointing out to you, that we know that this point in history, there is some confusion. Don't get confused which one we are referring to. Next, the Pasuk says, Hamoleich Mehodu Vad Kush. The word Hamoleich is quite unusual. I would have expected the Pasuk to say, Hu Achashverosh Hamolach, that ruled Mehodu Vad Kush. What's Hamoleich? Hamoleich is a funny term. So, Rashi points out over here Hamoleich, Shemalach Me'atzmo, V'lo Haya Mizera Hamalucha, that Achashverosh ruled by himself or from himself, meaning he took the initiative. He was not Mizera HaMalucha, he was not from royal blood, from royal seed, literally. So you see from Rashi, HaMoleich is indicating that he did something causative in his rule. HaMoleich, not HaMolach in the past tense that he ruled, but HaMoleich, that he is ruling, that there's something unusual about the terminology. Rashi says HaMoleich, that he caused himself to rule. He was an illegitimate king. He was rich, he was famous, he was powerful, and he managed to buy his way through this, that, or the other thing to become the king. Now, who did he marry? As we're going to see, he married Vashti. Vashti was his link to the actual royal lineage. Since he was married to Vashti, that certainly made him a legitimate king in the sense that the queen was the great-granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar from royal blood. So his wife, at least, was from royal blood, but he, however, was not, Rashi says, indicated by the word Hamaleich. We're going to speak what's the significance of that as we proceed. Pasuk Beis, Bayomim Hahem, in those days, Kesheves Hamelech Achashverosh Al Kisei Malchuso Asher B'Shushan HaBira. In those days, when the king sat on his throne, that was in Shushan HaBira, Shushan the capital, very strange. I mean, I don't know where kings usually sit. My impression is kings usually sit on thrones. They're not usually sitting on the floor. I don't know, maybe there's like an Asian tradition differently. But what do you mean? What's this pasuk trying to tell me? Bayomim Hahem, in those days, Kesheves Hamelech Achashverosh, when the king Achashverosh sat, Al Kisei Malchuso, on the chair of his majesty, meaning his throne, Asher B'Shushan HaBira, that was in Shushan. And then it goes on to discuss, V'Shnas Shalosh L'Malcho V'Samishteh, in the third year of his reign, he made a party. So what in the world is this pasuk coming to add? It doesn't tell me what year it was, that's in the next pasuk. And that's pasuk we find out, V'Shnas Shalosh L'Malcho, it was the third year of his reign. So that's when he made this party. And if we're familiar with Megillas Esther, that's when we know the episode with Vashti happens, and he ends up killing Vashti because of this following episode. But the introduction is in those days when the king was sitting on his throne that was in Shushan the capital. So if you want to tell me that this episode is occurring in Shushan, I understand. Why do I need to know that he was sitting on his throne in Shushan? We can make this much simpler. Bayamim Ahim B'Shushan HaBira. Pashut. In those days in Shushan. Why do I need to know anything about his chair? And why do I need to know that it was in Shushan? What is this all about? So, Rashi, assumingly Lishi Tasso, following from what he just mentioned, that the king was an illegitimate king, Achashverosh is not a royal lineage, comments on Pasuk Beis, Kesheves HaMelech Achashverosh, Keshen Iskayim HaMalchus B'yado. Kesheves, according to Rashi, means when he became comfortable. When he became comfortable, he made this party. That's how Rashi interprets Kesheves. It has nothing to do with him physically sitting on his chair. Obviously, we don't care if he was physically sitting on his chair. But what it means, according to Rashi, is Kesheniskayim Amalthus Biyado, when he was comfortable, when people had accepted him as king. So then he went ahead and he made the following party. The Vilna Gaon comments on Pasuk Beis, something that focuses on the chair. He writes, Pirshu Amidrashim, Shezeh Kisei Hutzir Mikisei Shashlom HaMelech Alav HaShalom. When Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, and he conquered the kings of Judah, he exiled the people and also took spoils. Among the spoils was the throne that originally had belonged to King Solomon, to King Shlomo. King Shlomo, according to various midrashim, even had a mechanized throne, that there were certain parts that moved to it. And according to the midrashim, this throne refused to let anybody sit on it. Certainly that wasn't rule over the entire world. And Achashverosh wouldn't let him sit on it at all. There's even a midrash that broke his foot when he tried to sit on it. Whatever it was, he apparently, Achashverosh, had a model, a version of this throne made to mimic the throne of King Shlomo. He made another one identical to Shlomo's throne because he wasn't able to sit on it. It took them 3 years to make it. They were unable to make anything like it except in Shushan. Shushan, where they had the craftsmen that were capable of producing such a work. Since both Achashverosh and this throne was so tremendously huge, as it is explicit in the Targum Sheni, they were unable to bring this throne to Babylonia, that was where the kings used to have their capital, and he ended up going to Shushan to make it its capital. Because all the previous kings sat in Babel, in Babylonia. So in other words, the Vilna Gaon is telling us that this pasuk is telling us something very interesting. In those days, when the king was able to finally sit on his throne, he couldn't sit on his throne before, that's right, he had to have this throne made, and it took them 3 years to make it, and apparently he didn't even sit on a throne until the third year, when finally his throne was completed. So he finally sat physically on his throne. That says the Vilna Gaon is telling us something, because he made this throne like King Shlomo's. Asher b'Shushan HaBira. Why do I care it was in Shushan HaBira? So there is a greater significance to this that we'll see in a minute, but for now, suffice it to say that the throne was in Shushan HaBira. Why was the throne in Shushan HaBira? Because Shushan never used to be the capital of the kingdom of Paras Umadai. The kings before Achashverosh did not have their capital in Shushan. This was something that Achashverosh initiated. Why in the world did he initiate this? Because of his throne, because the throne was unable to be moved, so he decided instead of trying to move the throne, he would move the capital to Shushan. The Vilna Gaon goes on to tell us a tremendously important yesod that we're going to need to remember when we learn Megillas Esther. Al kisei malchuso asher b'shushan, perush, on his throne that was in Shushan. The explanation of this is, halosu kisei asher b'shushan dafka, on that throne that was specifically in Shushan. Habira, perush, the explanation of Habira is, huchosei gadol asher b'ir malucha l'moshav malachim v'sarim katsinei am. Kamot Sion v'Yerushalayim, Zehu Bira. Bira, according to the Vilna Gaon, means a stronghold. It means a place which is fortified. It's where the kings sit. Abira Sher Achinosi, Kamosh, Omer Daniel, etc. Because of Zos, the Vilna Gaon is wondering what we asked originally. Why is this significant? Why do we care that it's in Shushan Habira? Why do we care about the throne? Why do we care about any of this? This is the Yisod of the Vilna Gaon. Because of Zos, the Haros, Gedulas Hashem Yisparach. This is written to show us the greatness of Hashem. Shesibev Sivuvin La'asos Neis LeYisrael. He created all sorts of convolutions in order to produce a miracle for the Jewish people. Because Mordechai lived in Shushan, as we see in Perek Beis, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan, that Mordechai lived in Shushan. He was already there. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the situation such that Achashverosh would be in Shushan and be there. In other words, instead of bringing the tzaddik to the neis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought the neis to the tzaddik. Ulefikach Amar, Shitzarach L'Krosa Kula. Here the Vilna Gaon implicitly asks a question. The halacha is, in the Gemara Megillah Yod Tes Amud Aleph 19a, that one, to fulfill his obligation of reading the Megillah on Purim, has to read the entire Megillah from the beginning to the end. Why is that significant? What else would we expect? Take, for example, a Haftarah that we read every week in Shul on Shabbos. We don't always start at the beginning of a perek. We don't always start at the beginning of a given story. Sometimes you'll start the story in the middle. It's whatever is relevant. for example, if you're reading from the Torah on Pesach, you're going to read the section about Pesach. If you need a few more aliyahs, okay, so we'll start a little bit earlier with some other holidays. But if we don't need to any more aliyahs, we don't need any more psukim, you read exactly what's relevant to the day. So too here, if we're going to read Megillas Esther, why in the world should we start by Yehi B'mei Achashverosh? Why would we even bother telling a story about Vashti? Just to begin with Esther. Similarly, at the end, you'll neither have to talk about the Jews standing up for their lives or anything else, or you don't have to talk about the taxes at the end of Achashverosh, the last pasuk, second to last pasuk, whatever it is. It's enough to just talk about the story, the miracle itself. So why do you need to read the entire Megillah, things that are totally irrelevant to the miracle of Purim? That's the question that Vilna Gaon is asking. Why do we care how mighty and how wealthy Achashverosh was? As we're going to see, that it describes the how regal and how extravagant the party that he made was. The answer of the Gra is as follows. Every single pasuk in Megillas Esther, this is his novelty here. This is his chidush. Every single pasuk in Megillas Esther is telling us something about the nace of Purim. Every pasuk somehow glorifies and magnifies the miracle of Purim. Achanesu b'Hester Panim. However, the miracle is with what's called Hester Panim, hiding of the face. Klomar, that is to say, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made sure to make all the miracles of Purim in a natural way. Very much unlike Mitzrayim, when God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, where everything was B'yad HaChazakah, V'zron and Netuyah, open miracles and ridiculous things happening. And in fact, he says, that's why we remember every single day, V'chol Yom Tov, V'Shabbat, Yisrael, Mitzrayim, we are constantly remembering the exodus from Egypt. But the nace of Purim, even though there on Purim we went actually from a threat of death, it was the first Holocaust, Rachmana Litzlan, from life to death, from death to life we went. So that you'd expect we should mention much more if there was a miracle that God saved us from death. Of a Mitzrayim, Hayam Avod Lecheres, from Egypt, from the saving the exodus of Egypt, that was from being slaves to being free. It's not nearly the same thing. Obviously, we should mention Megillas Esther every day in davening, no? Why should we mention the exodus from Egypt if we only went from slaves to being free men? We should mention something when God totally saved our lives, no? So what's going on? Why is it that Esther is not mentioned every single day? Purim is not mentioned every single day. We have a mitzvah to remember, Yitzhas Mitzrayim, not Purim. It's like Chazal said in the Gemara Nechulin, 139b, Esther mina Torah minayin. Chazal have a very unusual question. Chazal say, where do you find Esther in the Torah? Where do you find Esther in the Torah? I can answer that one. It's Megillas Esther. So Chazal clearly have a different idea in mind. Esther mina Torah minayin. And the Gemara answers because the pasuk says, Devarim 31:18, Va'anochi chaster astir panai bayom hahu. When God is saying that when the Jewish people are going to not do the right thing, that he's going to punish them, he's going to bring, Rachmana Litzlan, terrible tragedies to the Jewish people to remind them to serve God. And God says, I will surely hide my face from them on that day. It's a very, very strange Gemara. Why is the Gemara asking specifically about Esther? Where do you find Esther in the Torah? There are lots of miracles that happened to lots of tzaddikim in the history of the Jewish people. Why is the Gemara so focused on finding out what the root of Esther is in the Torah? A strange question in any case. V'hainu. This is how the Gemara explains it. A miracle in the land of Israel is not such a novelty. In fact, if you look in Pirkei Avos, it says that in the times of the first temple, there were many miracles happening daily. The smoke that would go up from the Mizbeah, from the altar where the sacrifices were burnt, no matter how strong the wind was, it couldn't make that column of smoke waver in the slightest. There were no flies. A woman never had a miscarriage. On and on, and miracles that were visible, or noticeable at least, every single day. No one ever was bitten by a poisonous snake. take a look in Pirkei Avos to see all the things that happened that were miraculous. And therefore, the miracle of Chanukah is not as great as that of Purim, because Purim occurred outside of the land of Israel. But Chanukah was in the times of the temple. It wasn't as much of a novelty. It wasn't as great of a nace. And when the Gemara says, where do you find Esther in the Torah? Perusha, this is what it means. Where is it hinted that even in the Hester Panim, at a time when God hides his face, which means in exile, how do we know that God still does miracles for us? Certainly a great nace like the one that it took on Purim. How do we know that God still does miracles for us in exile? Maybe when we're in exile. So God really has abandoned us, and he's waiting for us to come back. So the Gemara is asking a tremendously important philosophical question. How do we know that God is going to continually be involved with us to the extent that he's even going to manipulate history and pull strings and make miracles for us, even in exile? And the Gemara answers, because the Pasuk says, "V'anochi haster astir ponai v'yomahu," I will surely hide my face. I will surely hide my face. Wait a minute, if God's hiding his face, doesn't that mean that he has nothing to do with us? Perush. The answer is no. He's hiding his face. You can't see him, but he's still actively involved. That, says the Gemara, is what the Gemara means. That God is hiding his face in exile. It means that God is involved. You just can't tell, obviously. Even at a time of Hester Panim, I'm hiding my face, I will send you an Esther. So he goes into other things that he explains based on this. But let's just finish up with this point. He gives a mashal. There's a king. The king has an only son. And of course, all the various ministers and other noblemen in the king's palace are jealous of this king's only son. And they see how much he loves him, so it just furthers their jealousy. In any case, one day, the son does something terrible. He does something terrible towards his father that the father considers insulting. And the father is so upset by it, and he needs the son to recognize that he did something wrong, that he goes so far as to actually kick him out of the palace. And the son, the prince, is forced to wander around in the forest. So the son thinks that his father has abandoned him and completely forgotten about him. He doesn't care about him anymore. He kicked him out. Goodbye and good luck! But the truth is, the father, with the great mercy that a father always has for his son, is seriously concerned that maybe something will happen to him when he's wandering around this forest, that maybe there are going to be wild animals that could devour him, or maybe some of the jealous ministers will attack him. So what does the king do? On the one hand, he doesn't want the prince to think that he didn't do anything wrong, but on the other hand, he wants to make sure that he's safe. So he sends bodyguards with specific instructions to hide and never ever reveal themselves or their presence to the prince, in order that the prince will do teshuva, he'll come back. So of course what happens is one day there's a bear, and you know, out of nowhere, you know, there's a golf ball, and it nails the bear on the head, and the bear falls down dead. You know, like, wow, I didn't even realize there was a golf course around here. Like out of nowhere, suddenly the son is saved. The next day something else happens. There's a snake, who knows what, and a rock falls out of a tree, smashes the snake on the head right before, you know, the venomous viper bites the prince. Eventually, the prince gets the sense, you know, this is there's something fishy going on around here. Till finally he understands that, you know what, this the entire time it's been my father protecting me. That's when the love that the father actually has for the son starts, the son starts to feel it. And then he actually comes and returns to his father, b'shuvah shalema, with a complete teshuva. So too, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's his relationship with us when we're in exile. He threw us out, not because he doesn't like us or because he doesn't want us anymore, but because he wants us to recognize our mistakes. And he wants us to do teshuva. He wants us to come back. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu also, so to speak, is afraid of what's going to happen to us along the way in the dangerous forest. So therefore, he sends us constantly his bodyguards with specific instructions not to reveal themselves, So constantly miracles are happening. However, those miracles are always behester upon him, with God hiding his face, so that we shouldn't easily recognize that this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement. However, Mordechai ve'Esther ve'Doram, Mordechai, Esther, and their generation saw and understood that this was all min hashamayim, and therefore they accepted the Torah, the Ahava. He's probably making reference here to the Gemara. The Gemara says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah on Har Sinai, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you have to accept the Torah. He put a mountain over their heads and he said, if you accept it, great. If not, Shom Tehe Gevurashchem. This is where you're going to die. That's it. So the Gemara says, Mekan Moedah Rabba Le'Araisa, that you see from here that the Jewish people were forced. The Jews were forced to accept the Torah. They didn't have a choice in the matter. The Gemara goes on, however, Hadar ki Beluha b'mei Achashverosh. Later on, they accepted it willingly in the days of Achashverosh, in the days of Purim. Well, why? Why did they accept it so willingly in the days of Achashverosh? Well, what's going on? So maybe Pshat in this Vilna Gaon is exactly this point. That when a person is being forced and he's following the rules and he sees the Torah as a rule book that he has to follow, and he maybe even is a rule person, so he likes to have the structure, it's okay, he follows it because he has to. That's what he, in a certain sense, he enjoys it, he feels fulfilled. But on the other hand, there is eino doma, there is nothing like a person who feels the love that his father has for him, that even when he kicked him out, he only did it so that we should have a closer relationship. And he only did it so that I should realize my mistakes. And he's constantly keeping an eye on me to make sure that chas v'shalom, nothing should go wrong, nothing in the slightest. I shouldn't have a scratch. With that sense of love, so that we're able to come back to Kadosh Baruch Hu and say, wow, you know, we really owe a Kadosh Baruch Hu, thank you. He really cares about us. And that creates a totally different attitude in our avodas Hashem, in our service of Hashem, and how we look at the Torah, how we look at the mitzvahs. Hadar kiblu b'mei Achashverosh, that later on they accepted the Torah in the days of Achashverosh with a tremendous ahava, with a tremendous love. That's what they saw in the times of Esther. So the Gra gives a mashal, Hester upon him, that when God hides his face, it means only that he's hiding his face, not that he's not involved. So in exile, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still involved, but in a secret way, in a way that is natural. So the Vilna Gaon tells us that every single thing that happens in Megillas Esther, that's why we have to read it all the way from the beginning, because every single point is somehow to magnify and glorify the nace of Purim. So to just finish with one more point, how do you see that? So take for example, in the first pasuk, it says, in the days of Achashverosh, he was Achashverosh that ruled from Hodu Vad Kush. So Hamolech. So Rashi tells us that he molach me'atzmo, that he was not of royal lineage, and he ruled of his own accord. He brought himself into the kingdom. So what does this add to the nace of Purim? Why do we need to know this? So I'd like to make a suggestion. This shows how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu was involved to do crazy things that no one ever would have expected would happen. How so? What allowed the nace to ever even happen in the first place? The first thing that has to happen is that Esther has to become queen. Now that's as unheard of as anything I can imagine. A woman that, first of all, she was a Jew. They didn't know it, but she was a Jewish girl. Not of royal lineage as far as they were concerned, as far as anybody other than Esther and Mordechai knew. Not a royal lineage, just some girl off the street happened to be a nice pretty girl, to become the queen. How did she become queen? Because as we're going to see, something absurd happened, that Vashti didn't listen to Achashverosh when he wanted her to come, so she rebelled against him, so he went ahead and got rid of her. Getting rid of Vashti is crazy enough, as we're going to see, just for the reasons that it happened. But more than that, that Achashverosh should get rid of the only thing that made him a legitimate king? How is that possible? What kind of crazy man would do that? That's the only thing that made him legit. And nonetheless, that's what allowed Esther to come into play. So the fact that Hamolech, that Achashverosh, brought himself into the kingdom, he was an illegitimate king, and he molach me'atzmo, he stuck himself into the kingdom. So that just glorifies the nace, and it shows how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a hand in making sure that Vashti would be killed, would be thrown out, to make room for Esther and the nace of Purim. That's the Yesod of the Vilna Gaon. Every single point in Megillas Esther, if you just focus on it, you'll see how it magnifies and glorifies the nace of Purim in one way or another. Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu, even in the exile, is constantly involved with us. That's how much he loves us, that he doesn't want chas v'shalom anything to happen to his boys while they're in exile, while they're in the forest. He wants them to do teshuva, to come back, and be back in the palace where they belong.